nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
All right, guys. Well, welcome to the afternoon session of the NSAC, OSA, SPIE, and the Berk internal conference. So our speaker is Professor Weinstein, and I guess I won't waste any more time.
Thanks, Sam. All right, and thank you for inviting me to speak at this. I think this kind of conference is a great idea, and to get a sense of what everybody else is doing in the center, and it's a really fantastic thing to see, and I hope we make it an annual thing or even biannual. So I want to talk a little bit today about the work going on in our research group, the Hybrid MEMS Lab, and specifically our work in resonators as an enabling technology. So hopefully most of you know what MEMS is, microelectromechanical systems, tiny things that most of the time move due to electrical signals. But we're in an age where it's basically a ubiquitous technology. There's MEMS in everything. Some sampling you see here, you know, obviously physical sensors have become, you know, prolific, accelerometers and gyroscopes in automotive applications, SLR camera stabilization, in your phones, in your smart watches and so forth. But there are a range of other things, including microphones, projectors, health monitoring, and various other things, including filters for wireless communication, that are all MEMS, all using this microelectromechanical technology. And you might not even know that it's there. So whether or not we want this to happen, whether or not it's a good thing, we are in the age of the Internet of Things, where people, for some reason or another, want everything to sense everything and to know everything about us and to be able to communicate that in some smart way to everything else, right? And that extends from smart buildings and energy applications, healthcare and life sciences, transportation, networks, and so forth, right? And kind of bridging across all of this, the urgence for IoT brings about a necessity for this. Basically percolates down into a few things. One, we need smart objects, right? We need things that can sense, right? And we need things that may, through some level of automation, maybe through actuators, can actually act or react to the environment. We need RF technologies that can help these smart objects communicate to each other or to some base station, right? We need machine-to-machine communication to facilitate that. And we need a central hub of information, right? This is basically what the Internet of Things boils down to. So I'm going to focus here on the smart objects and RF technologies, but ultimately all of these things can be enhanced and can be improved with and require fundamentally resonators. Resonators can be used for timing, right? Everything and anything needs oscillators, needs clocks in order to function, and to function in a smart way. Wireless communication relies heavily on resonators for frequency generation, for filters, for mixing, etc., all sorts of signal processing. Even sensors themselves, of course, can benefit from resonators. High quality factor resonance translates to high signal to noise ratio. So this is a bit of a Goldilocks situation. What kind of resonators should we use, right? And there are some applications where one type of resonator or another might be beneficial. But if we look simply at velocity of waves, right? And at the relevant frequencies of interest for the majority of IoT things, smart objects, we are typically, for wireless communication as well as for certain sensing applications, and timing, we want to be in the, let's say, hundreds of megahertz to 100 gigahertz range. You want large data transfer rates, which mean large bandwidth, which means pushing up into 5G frequencies. That's up in the 30 to 60 gigahertz range. And so in order to do this, in order to scale up to these frequencies, you know, we can kind of take a look and see some typical media that we have waves in. So if we have an air acoustic cavity, like a tuba, for example, right? The very, very slow velocity of acoustic sound in air would mean that at 1 gigahertz, we would have a resonance cavity, basically a half wavelength, which is the smallest resonance cavity that you could have, would be on the order of 170 nanometers. At 60 gigahertz, of course, it would be impossibly small. If we look on the other end of the spectrum and use light, or electromagnetic waves, then an electromagnetic cavity is going to have a lambda over 2 or an acoustic a resonance cavity that's on the order of 15 centimeters at 1 gigahertz, 2.5 millimeters at 60 gigahertz. This starts to become a useful value, but still, you know, larger than what we would like. So kind of sitting right in the middle between those is acoustic resonators in kind of typical microprocessing materials. For example, a silicon acoustic resonator. And when we say acoustic here, we mean elastic waves vibrating in this crystal, essentially. At 1 gigahertz, you have 4.3 micron resonance cavity. At 60 gigahertz, 70 nanometer. So this is really the sweet spot of lithography capabilities and standard micromanufacturing and nanomanufacturing processes. They also have very high quality factor, not as high as electromagnetic waves, but very high quality factor necessary to get low phase noise clocks, frequency selective filters, and so forth. Okay, so let's talk about silicon resonators for 3 seconds. If you take a look, using micromanufacturing technology and thin film processing, which kind of kicked off in the 1980s, where polycrystalline silicon became popular as a mechanical material, in addition to being obviously the gate of transistors at the time. So we really, MEMS really leveraged everything that the IC technology was putting out there and then modifying it a little bit in order to make moving structures. This was one of the seminal works and seminal devices in 1989, the comb drive resonator, which basically uses Coulomb force. If you apply a voltage across a capacitor between two, let's say, parallel plates, you have positive, equal and opposite charges on either side. They attract and the two plates pull together, right? This makes motion from an electrical signal. You can make that force larger by intradigitating many of these fingers together. And this was back in 89. If you look in your phones now, don't do it, it'll ruin your phone. This is basically what you're going to see, the exact same thing, lots and lots of little interdigitated fingers forming these air gap capacitive transducers. Transducers, I mean, converting something that'll convert energy between the mechanical and electrical domain and vice versa. So it's pretty much been done the same way for the past 30 years. There are limitations, though, and this is an SEM of such a comb drive, and you see the fixed electrodes and moving electrodes and the charges sloshing back and forth as the voltage is turned on and off. Okay, but there are major limitations to these air gap transducers, and one of the things that we first looked at was to see how can we change that transduction, that basic way of converting the energy from electrical to mechanical domain to make things more efficient at higher frequency, right? We wanted to scale. This was all done at kilohertz range, maybe going into single to 10 megahertz. But there are major limitations for that, both in fabrication as well as in performance when you try to scale up. So the first thing we did was basically get rid of that air gap and fill it with a dielectric. Of course, just doing that would not help. You need to look at exciting different kinds of mechanical motion that would be more efficiently transduced. And by doing that, instead of bending mode structures, we basically pulled on the crystal itself with bulk mode acoustic vibrations. And we're able, that's obviously going to be much stiffer and therefore much higher frequency. We were able to scale up to 6 gigahertz, which at that time was the record, with a dielectric sandwiched just between two polysilicon regions in the same resonator. And we showed very high quality factor. We showed that the transduction actually improved as you went to higher frequency. So this was a great candidate. But then this got us thinking, well, okay, we want to scale to higher frequency. We need to route this signal on, you know, on and off this resonator, and to whatever functional circuits surround it. Ideally to make an oscillator, to make filter and so forth, right? You need additional surrounding support circuitry. At these frequencies, you can't just wire bond signals, right? It also turns out that in order to sense at these high frequencies and deal with, there's a lot of parasitic capacitance that will flood your mechanical signal, which has this high quality factor resonance that you're trying to achieve. So the best, kind of skipping 4 or 5 years ahead, the answer was to actually use CMOS technology and acoustically resonate transistors in the technology. So we use the gate dielectric, just like a capacitor, to drive capacitively these elastic waves in the transistor. And then as we're stretching and compressing the crystal, well, it's a piezo-resistive effect, right? People put stress liners on transistors in order to change their mobility, right? Well, why can't we sense this piezo-resistive modulation of the drain current and bypass all those capacitive parasitics that kill us at lower at these high frequencies? And so that's what we did. In that case, you're using standard CMOS technology and trying to make an acoustic resonator confine acoustic waves in CMOS. That's a challenging thing. Because there's not a lot of room to play with CMOS stack. The layers are fixed. The materials are fixed. You can't go around breaking rules for dimensions of different things. So what we ended up doing was actually using the back end metals, which you see up there, and forming a phononic crystal, right? Many of you have maybe worked with phononic or the optical and analog photonic crystals, right? This is basically a frequency selective mirror, right? It will not let certain frequencies in the band gap through. And so those frequencies get reflected. They get trapped in this cavity at the front end of the CMOS stack where all the transistors live. So you have a nice confined acoustic wave in the CMOS stack. No post-processing, no special packaging or anything like that. So with this kind of approach, we were able to get frequencies. This is using IBM's 32-nanometer SOI process. We were able to get cues of about 250 at 2.8 gigahertz. This was fine, but mechanical resonators, acoustic resonators, can do a couple orders of magnitude better than this. So there was room for improvement. And it turned out we were trying to force, what is it, a square peg into a round hole? Something like that. And trying to force the CMOS stack to do what we wanted it to do. Instead, if you kind of look at what the CMOS stack can offer and see what acoustic waves can exist in the stack, can I make the stack into an acoustic waveguide? Right? Kind of like, index matching in some way, and confine the waves to travel horizontally. And so the structure started to get a little bigger, but the quality factor improved by a whole bunch. We were able to get 13,000 at about 3 gigahertz in the same technology, right? And this was a much better approach to basically looking at what the stack is and what localized modes can exist in it. So you reduce scattering at all sorts of non-ideal boundary conditions and so forth. Basically looking at the dispersion relations for acoustic waves in a CMOS stack, which nobody had really looked at before. Okay, so this was great, but still not good enough to make oscillators. The biggest problem was that our signal was too low. This had to do with a few different factors, but primarily the fact that these are planar transistors, and we're basically stressing the dielectric, the gate dielectric vertically, and wanting it to couple into a wave that is propagating in plane. So finally, we had access to FinFET technology, and once we had vertical fins and a nice geometry, very small pitch, so you could go to very high frequency, we were able to finally obtain a much higher frequency, high Q response. Here's a 32 gigahertz acoustic resonance with a quality factor of over 1,000, and the signal, the electromechanical transconductance, was improved by about 100 times over the previous generations. So with this, we're now able to finally get to the next step. We're designing oscillators in collaboration with Shreya Sen's group through the DARPA MIDAS program. And hopefully, I think the tape out went to factory today. Yep. So we'll hopefully get oscillators back soon based on those devices. Now, people are starting to introduce some crazy materials into CMOS. 10 years ago, this wasn't really accepted. People were a lot more traditional, but they're getting desperate now. People are talking about ferroelectrics in the gate dielectric to make memory devices. TI has already shown ferroelectric capacitors using PZT, lead in a CMOS foundry. What? That is used in a commercial sense for memory devices. So we teamed up with TI because we don't have access to the latest ferroelectric gate dielectric devices yet. So we teamed up with TI to see if we can kind of achieve the same acoustic waveguiding principle and make resonators using piezoelectric materials like PZT that have a much better conversion between mechanical and electrical domain just due to the inherent nature of the material. And we were able to do that. So this is a cross-section of an acoustic waveguide of ferroelectric capacitors in the back end. So these are metal layers above, the transistor layer is down here below. And there's this thin layer of PZT, 70 nanometer, sandwiched in between, which can help us drive and sense acoustic waves. And so we saw some very interesting, we were able to get quality factors actually over 1,000 at 700 megahertz. But we also saw some interesting behavior associated with this nonlinear material. We were able to kind of tune the resonator both in amplitude, both in allowing a peak resonance, and depending on the bias voltage on the PZT, a notching effect. So this can be very interesting for programmable filters for ad hoc radios. So we're exploring that option currently in more depth. Okay, so silicon is not the only technology, the only material platform out there. Of course, there's a lot of exciting work going on in gallium nitride and other 3-5 materials. And one major benefit of gallium nitride for us is that it is both a semiconductor and piezoelectric. So again, this piezoelectricity is a material property that converts electrical and mechanical energy directly, as opposed to capacitive transduction, which is a nonlinear behavior and is less efficient and limited by the absolute capacitance of the transducer. So using gallium nitride and specifically the AlGaN-GaN heterostructure, which forms this 2D electron gas at the interface between them, this is used for HEMTs, right, in MMIC technology, very high mobility, electron charge, very high charge density, can be very interesting for for, again, tunable or switchable devices where we can make that 2-deg, control that 2-deg with a bias voltage. We demonstrated very high Q resonators with low insertion loss, which, again, very good for filters. We demonstrate a variety of different capabilities in a slight modification to the standard MMIC-HEMT process, and demonstrated switchable devices, high Q Lamb mode resonators, where the lithographic dimensions can define your frequency, so you can have multiple frequencies on a single chip, and even demonstrated phononic crystals in this kind of structure to get very, very good spurious mode suppression to clean up the frequency response, get rid of any resonance modes you don't want. Also very important both for filtering as well as for oscillator applications. In the interest of time, I'll skip. We made filters. We made oscillators. It was all well and good. Now it's a matter of getting that working in the Burke clean room, using our technology, our processing capabilities here. Now, once you have these oscillators, you can think about coupling them together in various interesting ways, and perhaps with tuning that coupling, achieve oscillatory logic and non-Boolean information processing, fancy words for basically neuromorphic computing, or in this case, we looked at pattern recognition and leveraging gallium nitride-based oscillators for oscillatory logic. That was and is an ongoing project, and we have a collaboration with Jeff Rhodes in this domain. We're also looking at in gallium nitride platform, as well as in some other material platforms, including lithium niobate, which is an even more piezoelectric material, the acousto-electric effect, which is an interesting interaction between a piezoelectric material and a semiconductor, where there is an exchange of energy between the acoustic wave in the piezoelectric, which generates a field, which acts on free carriers like electrons in the semiconductor, which then, say, bunches the electrons, right? That non-uniform distribution of charge then generates a field of its own and acts back on the piezoelectric. So through this interaction, you can get amplification of acoustic waves using just a DC bias, which is very unusual, with, in principle, low noise amplification. You can similarly attenuate such signals. You can tune the velocity of acoustic waves. You can do more complex things like correlators, circulators, and so forth. An interesting property, of course, is that this behavior depends on the ratio of the free carrier velocity to the acoustic wave velocity. And so if my wave is going in one direction and my electrons are going in the same direction, I'll have one effect. If my wave's going in one direction and electrons going in the other, I can have the opposite effect. So it's a non-reciprocal process. And once you have non-reciprocal process, you can get isolators, circulators, various things that are critical for RF front ends that are kind of simultaneous transmit and receive radios. But you can also make interesting things like topological insulators with a proper combination of such devices. So we're exploring this space as well, and have had some initial results in gallium nitride, and are now pushing forward in lithium niobate. All right, finally, as a complete departure from all of that, working 10 to 15 years in resonators is very exciting, but in looking for new ways to tune these acoustic resonators, we stumbled onto a collaboration with Shriram Ramanathan, who has this material, which you guys have heard of phase change materials like vanadium oxide, and GST and germanium telluride, which undergo an amorphous to crystalline transition. This is used, of course, for memory devices and is explored in this space, but it is a thermally driven process. What Shriram created or discovered was the use of complex nickelates, like neodymium nickelate, for example, NNO for short, which, rather than a phase change material, is a phase transition material. It's crystalline to crystalline, but rather than inducing this phase change, metal to insulator phase change, using a thermal process that will make the structure amorphous, he actually dopes it with protons. So, which can be done with a bias field, with a voltage applied. So it's a voltage-driven phase transition, which, like the phase change materials, induces this huge strain in the material. And when a MEMS person hears huge strain, they think, oh, wonderful, actuators. Or for resonator people, oh, I can tune the mechanical properties of the material and change my resonance frequency. Okay. So we started exploring this route, and it turns out that there are some pretty remarkable numbers out there for what this actuator material should achieve. They've been exploring it for memory for a long time, but never for actuation. And so we have a new program looking at this actuation using voltage-driven nickelates for microrobotics. All right, so through the SHRIMP program from DARPA as well, we have an effort, which I'm pretty proud of the name, NOMAD, because we're trying to make untethered microrobots, not unlike nomads that can go off on their own and explore the world, using this material. And ultimately, the ultimate goal of this is to actually make microrobots that then compete in a microrobot Olympics, you know, with various things like high jump, long jump, weightlifting, shot put, and absolute force. So that'll be an interesting thing to see develop over the next, DARPA's short term, right? So next couple of years. So with that, I want to thank the people who actually do the work. This is the current hybrid MEMS lab, hopefully we're growing in the next couple of years a little bit more. But these guys have done some phenomenal work, and we hope to see a lot more out of them. Thank you, guys. Mm-hmm.